Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. Often we have guests who have done a number of things. My guest today is one of the rare folks who has been at one place for 35 years. He's celebrating his 35th anniversary at GQ, and it's Jim Moore. Jim, thanks for being here so much.
Elvis, thank you so much. It's an honor to be here with you.
You clearly haven't heard the show before, but that's okay. And one of the reasons I want to have you here is just that my reading trip at GQ goes back to when I was in junior high, and I subscribed, and I remember in the early 70s, they sent a questionnaire with a quarter to tip your favorite newsboy with, and I used that quarter to pay for my subscription.
That's incredible. I had no idea. We got to bring that back.
But one of the things I like what your tenure seems to suggest is that there is a consistent narrative to the magazine's aesthetic. Would you agree with that?
I think there definitely is a GQ look. Obviously, it changes, and you know the tides change over the years, especially when you think of the three decades I've been there through. I've started in 1980, interned a little bit in 79, so I kind of was there when we moved kind of from the Peacock generation into a little bit more of a conservative, you know, Reagan era, preppy kind of style era. There is something that we really, that you could call the GQ look. I recently was asked to go through 35 years of GQ. Naively, I thought it would take about an hour and a half. Of course, it took me 3 days because it's quite a memory lane. And I noticed that there were some things, you know, over 35 years, 35 plus years that are consistent in the GQ vocabulary. You know, one being, you know, a beautiful plaid blazer like you're wearing, or a Oxford cloth shirt, or even a camel coat, or anything striped or collegiate looking. And, you know, our look is very, you know, obviously we tend to have a little bit of an American look. We obviously love European designers and love to incorporate that into the look of GQ. And so I'd say it's probably an international continental style. It's snappy. We like, you know, we like color. We like pattern. We like guys to feel confident about themselves. And hopefully we give them the tools so they can get up in the morning, feel good about themselves, and make themselves look different than the guy sitting in the cubicle next to them.
One of the things that I think that's run so often in GQ, and then this gap line you guys do is really symbolic of that, is it's the magazine has so often been a champion of smaller designers, which I've always liked about it. That sure, you see Dolce and Giorgio Armani is celebrating the magazine just because he's had such an enormous effect over menswear of the past, basically since you've been doing this. But there's so many smaller lines that have gotten their starts and have been celebrated in the magazine.
Yeah, and I think the younger, you know, generations, you know, the class of 2014, 2015 that we're working with presently for The Gap, they're definitely influenced by the big guns. I mean, none of them could do anything without Giorgio Armani and Ralph Lauren and Miuccia Prada and Tom Ford and a bunch of other designers out there. But I think what I'm really loving about what's happening now and what's happening in the fashion culture in America and menswear is that these guys are really in it to win it. They're not just in here to make a few T-shirts. They're not in here to, soap a few things in their garage and try to sell them, you know, online. They are, you know, they're also business people, and they have goals and they have long range plans, and frankly that's who we cast our eyes on. We want someone who is really hungry for it, who really sets his eye on the prize, her eye on the prize, and wants to go for it. And then we can really get behind them because we know that they're serious about being a designer. They're serious about being the next Marc Jacobs or the next Ralph Lauren.
But the thing that I think so often you can pick up any issue over the past 30 years, certainly, but I feel like certainly in this past 15 years and find a couple of designers you don't know. And I've got to figure that's part of the excitement for you is seeing these pieces come from folks who you think are injecting a new kind of excitement into what people are wearing.
Definitely. I think that one of the things we really love to do, and you really hit the nail on the head, is that we love to tell our readers about new designers. We love to put in our pages of manual, for example, we'll do something called labels you've never heard of, you know, brands that we want to educate you about, brands that, you know, you may see in a store, but maybe you're a little apprehensive about buying them because there's not an ad campaign behind them. There's not a lot of, you know, a lot of push behind them. But we want to encourage guys to seek out those brands. And it could be something American, could be something Scandinavian, could be something from, you know, a little town in Kansas. And, you know, that's what we love. And that's a really big part of the Gap Best New Menswear Designer Initiative. It's to get these designers, these four designers specifically, each year into the backyards of, you know, people in America and educate them and try to make their name a household name with a lot of guys out there who care about style.
Because I feel like part of this too is just, I feel like you're almost, I use the word curated before we sat down, but it feels like it's a curatorial eye in this. I feel like there's, you're almost putting together a gallery show in some way with these designers that you pick for something like this, the GQ Gap collection.
Yeah, it's a incredibly rewarding process because we get to work so closely with the designers, and they will come to us with their ideas, and you know, we love to mentor, we love to coach. To give you an example, David Hart, who's a great designer, who really has a little bit of a throwback mentality.
And does stuff almost like this.
Yeah, exactly. Does a retro plaid jacket, or we'll do a polo shirt with a stripe on it, or an Argyle cardigan, for example. I mean, he loves that kind of, that Rack Pack era. You know, and he presented his designs to us, and we thought they were really interesting, but he almost needed to be corralled in a little bit. So what we did is we gave the 8 or 10 pieces a cohesive color story. So it told a story, but it also is, we want to entice the consumer. We want them to feel that they can mix and match, but also put it all together because it matches perfectly. So, you know, there's a big item business with this, with Gap Best New Menswear Designers, but we also want to encourage guys to not only cross-pollinate from designer to designer, but also, you know, buy the whole collection and put it together the way we show it. That's a good thing also.
Well, see, that's why I used to use the word narrative when we sat down, and curation, because I do feel like for you, there is a story that you like to see told in this. And because all these designers who do so much stuff, there's a wealth of things to pick from. But for you, there is a kind of storytelling involved in this.
Absolutely. I think the big story this season is that there's four completely different talents here. You know, you have Chris Stamped, who sits in kind of a little bit more of a streetwear vibe, you know, a little bit more of a city culture, you know, very limited palette. You have David Hart, who we just spoke about, who has more of a retro vibe. You have the Hillside guys, who are a little bit more Japanese and textile influenced and very accessory driven. And then you have NSF, which is a California-based, you know, sportswear company, denim company, that really specializes in making, you know, one-of-a-kind, you know, jeans and really works on the handcrafting of destroying the jeans and making them look different. So I think we've got four artisans. I think we've got four different points of view. And I think when guys see it at the Gap, they're going to hopefully enjoy the curation. They're going to enjoy the fact that each designer is, you know, collection hangs together in hopefully a harmonious way, but also the fact that, you know, he can be preppy, but he can also, you know, wear a black leather hoodie jacket from NSF, or he can, you know, put on a pair of blanket striped Vans, slip-on sneakers from Hillside, but also wear, you know, a David Hart cardigan.
Because for me, I think it comes from, for you, that in so many of these collections, there's been that kind of four-quadrant thing. There's somebody who, we talked about Noir before we got started, and there's very much a kind of a streetwear hip-hop vibe to that.
Right.
I mean, bringing these things together just to show that you don't need to just buy pieces from one person, that the idea of just finding stuff, it almost like for me, you're educating your readership to go out and just try all kinds of things instead of just sticking to one person all the time.
I think you really hit the nail on the head what GQ Style is all about. And also is, you know, in addition to really not only, you know, exciting, enticing the reader about runway fashion and how designers put things together. We also love the idea of demystifying the runway also and showing that, you know, maybe that full look might be a little bit extreme in its complete, you know, character. But if you pull that aside, if you pull it apart, there's a beautiful tweed coat there, or there's a beautiful pair of sneakers. And you can mix those things into your regular, you know, lifestyle, whether it be a pair of Levi's or, you know, a cool John Elliott sweatshirt. So the GQ look is really about mixing. It's really about finding your own individual style and mixing high and low and mixing different designers together. And that's something that we always have, you know, raised the flag for. And that's, I believe, the heart and soul of great American style.
It's the treatment. I'm talking to Jim Moore, who's the creative director of GQ, who's been there for 35 years now. Tell me if you remember the first issue of GQ you picked up. What do you remember seeing in it?
Oh, wow. I remember I was probably in high school. I picked up a GQ from the 70s. I'm a child of the 70s. And, of course, I started GQ when I was 10. So, you know.
When you were 10.
Everybody's like, 35 years. I was like, yeah, don't do the math. You know,
I figured you were like 5 years old.
Yeah, that's good. I like five better. No, I started right out of college at GQ. But those years kind of leading up to it, I was quite obsessed with magazines, with all kinds of publications, except especially fashion, style, architecture, lifestyle, home magazines.
We should say there's at that point, I'm guessing roughly the same age, there's a real paucity of stuff for men. You know, I mean, GQ is one of the places you went to, because if you live in the United States, there weren't many places to look for men's fashion.
Absolutely. And I grew up in the Midwest. I grew up in the Twin Cities in Minnesota. And GQ is my real connection to, you know, the world, and especially to the big city. And, you know, I grew up in St. Paul, which is considered like the hick town compared to Minneapolis. So anytime I could cross the Mississippi to go to Minneapolis and kind of pretend like I was in New York City, or pretend like I was in a slightly more glamorous world. And, you know, it was that era. It was the 70s. It's like you dressed up a little bit more. You know, you put a little bit more effort into things. You probably wore a little bit more color and pattern, even more so than guys do today. And the fashion magazines were just filled with it. They were filled with something that was just starting to blossom then, called lifestyle. And, you know, Ralph Lauren was getting his feet wet, and he was definitely, thanks to the photography of Bruce Weber, was really establishing a new kind of advertising campaign, which was really about lifestyle.
And for him, too, coming out of the – there was a great Gatsby before Baz Luhrmann, we should tell our listeners, and Ralph Lauren was associated with that great Gatsby of 1975.
He was. It was Chariots of Fire, and it was Ralph Lauren. And, you know, that was really the takeaway. When you went to a Ralph Lauren store, you really bought into the idea of that lifestyle, that really beautiful, you know, well-groomed and super cool lifestyle. And I'd have to say, when I first started looking at GQ, it was a little bit crazier. It was wild. It was the disco generation. It was, you know, sometimes guys in lyrics jumpsuits.
And those Kiana shirts.
A lot of Kiana ads and Kiana shirts and skin tight this and that. Sometimes we look back at those ads and look back at those issues and we have a big chuckle. And sometimes we look back at them and we think it's incredible inspiration for something we want to do today, especially if you look at fashion today and bits and pieces of retroness that kind of string through the collections. So we are, you know, we're really proud of our heritage. I just got very addicted to the magazine early on, and as a young man in the Midwest, never really thought I'd actually be working for the magazine. But I knew that when I looked at a fashion magazine, I got excited. If it was a women's magazine or a men's magazine, specifically GQ, I wondered who was the person who actually was on those photo shoots, who make those clothes look great, who helped direct those photo shoots, who worked with the photographer. I didn't know the term stylist. I didn't know what a fashion editor was. But the fashion magazines was really an outlet for me. And I was going to find out who that person was, and I was going to try to get that job.
But there's also, in those days, really, there was a a kind of an artfulness to that. I mean, there are lots of locations in those days. I mean, there remember lots of shiny shirts in the deserts or on dunes. And, you know, you smile, so you know exactly the layouts I'm talking about.
Of course. And the issues were themed, you know. We would go to Egypt, you know, and the whole issue would be Egypt. And there'd be not only, you know, a swimsuit story in the sand dunes, but there'd also be a city story in Cairo. And then you'd have, you know, a grooming story, you know, on the terrace of a hotel in Luxor or something. So you would get your most out of your buck. You would go for a week or 10 days to these exotic locations. You'd shoot a whole magazine. And I think GQ is really in the forefront of the idea of kind of spinning the globe and just kind of, where do we want to go next? Where do we want to take our readers? Let's take them on a fantasy tour, but let's also show them that, you know, that cool polo shirt from, you know, Ralph Lauren or whomever it's from can look great, you know, in the sand dunes of Egypt as it does in the streets of Soho. So the whole idea of lifestyle photography was really born out of that generation. And that's a little bit closer to the end of the 70s and into the early 80s when the whole thing really started changing.
And also at that point too, in the 80s, it became more about dressing celebrities rather than, I mean, that's when that shift started to happen with the magazine too, wasn't it?
It did. It didn't happen until about 1983. We had a new editor-in-chief, Art Cooper, who was a brilliant journalist and incredible.
He came from Penthouse,
yes. And he, you know, he came in and he brought a new authority, and he wanted to make the magazine a huge success. He wanted it to make it popular to all different kinds of men, and he wanted to put celebrities on the cover. And I remember the first planning meeting when he said he wanted to do that. I was like, my God, I can't believe that we're not going to have models on the cover anymore. How is this magazine ever going to sell? Of course, fast forward not that much further into the future from that day, the magazine was selling a hotcakes, and you know, he made it a magazine that was you wanted to pick up and you wanted to read cover to cover, and the element of fantasy was still there, but it was mixed in with great articles about, you know, food and wine, politics and fiction, and you know, really, GQ became as much a great read as it did fashion and profiles on celebrities.
We'll take a break. We're getting our GQ on with Jim Moore, who's creative director of GQ, 35 years with the magazine. This is The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Take KCRW with you on one of our mobile apps. Available for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry devices. Stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and our News 24 and Eclectic 24 streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. I only read GQ. I don't look like I belong in it, but my guest does.
You do look like you belong in it.
Only on radio would somebody say that. It's Jim Moore, who's the creative director of the magazine. One of the things I thought, though, that GQ did, that Art Cooper did with that magazine was he changed fashion, and that from that, Vogue started putting celebrities on the cover. I think that the magazine's been influential in ways that people haven't really paid attention to.
I think you're right. I mean, it was only a matter of time before we were going to go that direction, but Art kind of, you know, it was a real line on the sand. Art was just, he closed the door on the model cover. And immediately the first cover was Joe Theismann, and it was a roaring success because not only was it a non-model cover, which marked the beginning of a new era, but it was also an athlete, which is wildly successful and wildly popular at that time. So the next cover was Michael Caine, and, you know, it kind of went on and on. And so the idea was to kind of, you know, offer up different celebrities that were, you know, involved in projects at that particular moment, but also from different occupations. So it would be a musician, or it would be an athlete, or in most cases, an actor.
But I think what's interesting too about all this for me is just that, I find myself going back to the word curation for what you do, and there must be some art background for you.
There is. I went to a technical school in St. Paul, and I learned about, it was called commercial art in those days. I wanted to be an art director. My teachers were a little frustrated with me because I would keep bringing in fashion magazines as my inspiration. And they said, well, that's fine for certain projects, but you need to have a...
Were you bringing the British magazines at that time? Were you bringing in ID or some of those things that were
around
at that point?
I would probably bring in anything that was fast in those days, fast fashion that I could get my hands on in St. Paul, Minnesota. So it was definitely Vogue and GQ and Glamour in those magazines. And if I, you know, there was a magazine called After Dark that was...
Oh!
That was... That is very inspirational, actually, to a lot of designers and art directors and photographers to
and
this
day.
And
there's almost kind of a line that sort of connected After Dark and GQ and the kinds of the models they would use.
There was. And there was a, you know, it was provocative and it was, the photography was exciting. And, there
and
was
Bruce
a certain,
Weber shot a lot of stuff for After Dark.
And Bruce Weber shot for it. And there was a carefreeness to it. There was kind of like the editorial was kind of up for grabs. And, you know, they didn't really care about, you know, circulation, so to speak. But it was an exciting magazine to look at. It was a niche magazine. And, you know, we all looked at it. We were all excited by it.
But there was a kind of a pop excitement to that magazine. And
Absolutely.
That sounds like that's the kind of thing that you were attracted to. That formed your aesthetic.
Yes. And I can't say I grew up saying I wanted to work for a men's fashion magazine, but I was very... You know, I was a guy who would go out of my way to find something that was a little bit more unusual to wear than the person next to me. You know, if it was a pair of jeans, it would have to be flared. If it was a shoe, maybe it had to be a platform. You know, I mean, we're talking about the 70s. But I think, you know, my instructors at my school were like, you know, fashion magazines are great, but you should also, you know, draw your inspiration from architecture and other designers and art directors. And I said, you know what? I think it was at that moment that I really realized that I needed to get to New York and I needed to learn about fashion. And that was a big moment because I knew nothing about fashion. I didn't want to be a fashion designer. I didn't want to work in retail. I wanted to work specifically for a magazine. So it was really those stacks of magazines that I would buy every month and just pore over for hours that became the inspiration for getting me to New York City and helping me get the job at GQ.
Because those kinds of things that you brought up After Dark, and boy, you really made me feel old with that. But also there was almost a kind of a storyboard aspect to After Dark. That again, that kind of storytelling that I see in a lot of the work that came after in GQ that clearly had an impact on you. That's why I find myself again going back to the word narrative.
Narrative is a really good word because, you know, something that we were doing kind of in the Bruce Weber era, right before the early 80s, right before Art Cooper came on board, and then it even excelled more under Art, is this idea of cinematic fashion and, you know, telling a story, and whether it was the story of, you know, 10 scenes from famous Cary Grant movies or, you know, doing... You know, literally trying to recreate Annie Hall because the clothes were, you know, kind of disheveled and preppy, kind of.
Although Woody Allen was wearing Ralph Lauren.
Exactly. We were storytellers. That's what we really liked to do at the magazine, and that was very. It was a big part of who we were, and a lot of the photographers that we worked with were really getting behind that, and they really understood that was the GQ look. So at that point, we were kind of looking at men's fashion, and for years and years, from the 70s to the 80s, it was that location thing, but it was also like a lot of suits and studio and, you know, simple backdrops. And, you know, how do we kind of like find a new way to invent the idea of showing men's fashion and showing it in an environment, in a purposeful location, and giving it a narrative. So that's kind of when we came up with the storytelling aspect of it. And I remember being with, you know, in the kind of mid 80s, being with Mario Testino, who was a very young, you know, kind of upstart photographer in those days. And
as compared to the old upstart he is now.
Yeah, exactly. He's pretty major right now and still works for the magazine and still a dear friend. But in those days, we went to Peru and did a James Bond story. So we went to Peru and did an Indiana Jones story. We did do a James Bond story, but that was in Los Angeles.
Oh, right, okay.
So you know, this was very typical. We would do, you know, 14, 16, 18 pages where we would tell the story of Indiana Jones. You know, we would go from the, you know, from Machu Picchu to, you know, Cusco to the Amazon to, you know, Lima, and literally, you know, cast extras. And, you know, I remember we brought 42 trunks of clothes and, you know, we were there for several days. And it was like putting a movie together, except you were on a budget and you had to get it done in 3 days. So, but that was exciting, and it helped really create what the magazine is. And it was, in those days, it was Arts Magazine, and he loved the idea of telling a story. And it, over the course of, you know, an Indiana Jones story, which would have been 14 pages, let's say, you would learn that, you know, you've got to get like a really great felt fedora and a distressed leather, you know, military jacket and the coolest cargos and a safari shirt.
And the right boots.
And the right boots and you know, a beautiful girl on your arm as well. So that was the story we were telling then.
It's a treat. We're talking about many things, but it all boils down to GQ with Jim Moore, the magazine's creative director. And one of the things that you must have, you see now and start to see basically in the mid-90s were designers who came out of, who were influenced by that kind of storytelling and that kind of cinematic aesthetic. And the first name that comes to mind, of course, is Tom Ford, who really is the child of this magazine. Yes. In so many ways.
Yes. I mean, if you, yeah, talk about After Dark and Interview and all of those magazines, it's definitely a lot to do with him. He is, you know, it's no secret that he loves the 70s, and he always, his fashion always points back to it. I mean,
but even movies, I mean, I've interviewed him before, and we've talked about the films of Adrian Lyne and,
yes,
and that kind of, that British commercial aesthetic, that glow, that was also something that those GQ we're talking about from the 70s had that too. So that we, it must be interesting to you because you got to beat the magazine long enough where you got to work with designers who were clearly influenced and turned on by what the magazine represented.
Yes, and you know, it's, a lot of people say what's the most exciting thing about working at the magazine? I said, well, first of all, it's the people that I work with, because it takes a village to put out a magazine every month. But also it's very interesting to see the ideals of men change over the years, and to also, you know, when you think about the 80s and you think about, you know, the preppydom of everything and how everything was a little bit more conservative and how you kind of made that into a storytelling. And then you got into the 90s where there was a huge influx of designers, and people like Tom Ford and Miuccia Prada were just starting to do menswear. And you had this, you know, Armani was at his peak and Ralph Lauren was doing incredible things. And then you had these new designers popping up like John Varvatos. And so it was a very exciting time. It at times, I think it was even a little bit confusing for the reader. And we had to really be careful about how we handled, you know, our narrative, because all of a sudden it's like, it's all about men's fashion and it's all about runway fashion, and it was a very, very exciting time. But I think it, you know, we were very careful to curate the pages in a way to show guys that, like, you know, I'd move them along but not frighten them. And I think, you know, you mentioned Tom Ford, who's an incredible storyteller and is so respectful of, you know, the craftsmanship of tailored clothing, and also how to drape the male body to make it look its absolute best and most masculine, but also to give one some extra maybe glamour and luxury that you might not have in your life. So I think fashion, like through the 90s, was really a positive thing. I think sometimes it was confusing for guys because it was kind of hitting from all different angles, and a lot of it was very avant-garde and some of it was super minimal. But I think in the end it was a very exciting time, because it was the moment when, you know, men's fashion really got its kudos and men's fashion really got its respect, and the men's fashion shows were crowded, and it was still not the circus of women's fashion shows, but it was high attendance and it was, you know, it was global, and we were suddenly on the map, and designers, women's designers, were suddenly designing men's clothes, and it was no longer that little, you know, that little corner in the women's boutique where, you know, there's some shirts and ties for your, you know, for your man. It was suddenly like a business. And I think the 90s was really an exciting time for that.
It's interesting too, because I just wonder, as you moved on through the magazine, I've always seen the film influence, and I know that, well, Tom Ford, Miuccia Prada is a student of film, certainly Tom Brown, a student of film, and so much of this comes out of that kind of glamour of the movies, and what a lot of, I think, the magazine has done is embolden men and taken away the fear of fashion that used to exist. I mean, that preppy them, you know, when you had the glory days of Tommy Hilfiger coming after Ralph Lauren, but it was really hip-hop that brought Tommy Hilfiger into the world, because mm-hmm. he couldn't get into mm-hmm. Ralph Lauren, but that kind of, the word you used before, the demystification, because no longer was fashion considered to be not masculine. Mm-hmm. I mean, it became, especially under the auspices of GQ, became a really masculine thing to pursue.
Right. I think we're in a really exciting time right now. I mean, I was very lucky 12 years ago to get a new editor-in-chief, Jim Nelson, who has brought an incredible, you know, sense of energy and
brought it much closer to the street. I mean,
it close to the street, and, you know, demystifying is really what he likes to do. You know, he likes to complicate the situation and, you know, think a little bit outside the box, obviously honor the franchise, but give us an exciting issue, give the readers an exciting issue every month, and maybe be a little bit unpredictable. And yes, maybe be a little bit younger, but also be bolder and cooler and, you know, and a little bit more global. And I think that might have been something that we were missing before, you know, as we kind of like coasted through the late 90s. So I think it's, you know, I'm super proud of where we are now. I feel like it's a really, you know, each issue just keeps getting better and better. And it's just one of these things that it's the team that Jim's put together is just phenomenal. And it's just a joy to be around all these smart people all the time and everyone kind of having their specialty. And, you know, men's fashion is really an exciting place right now, because it is really a celebration of the individual. And it kind of gets back to what you said before, like, you know, I love this whole cross-pollination of, like, you know, Tom Ford to street fashion to, you know, fast fashion. You know, of course, we have to bring that into consideration, that there's a lot of inexpensive clothes out there it's very seductive, you know, that you can buy something, you can buy a suit now for $250 that's skinny and it's pretty cool, and it's a slightly disposable, but it's still something that's part of the culture and very cool. So you've got this real mashup of a lot of different things, and I think more than ever we realize that our job is really to help guys navigate through all of this.
Because there's actually so many more choices now than there were
there's
before.
So many more choices. And if you just go into, you know, if you go into a Barney's or if you go into any store now that has a large denim selection, let's say, you get off the elevator, there's a hundred brands of denim. It's like even someone like myself who knows about denim, I would be confused as to what to buy. So I think it's important, and I think the stores are aware of it. Certainly Barney's and Bergdorf's and a lot of the specialty stores do it very well. Is you have to realize the men's customer is different than women's. They have a voracious appetite for shopping and for purchasing, but they want to be told, and they want to be convinced by how to put it together and how it should fit, and then they become extremely loyal consumers. If they love the fit of a Saint Laurent jacket, they're going to go back and buy a pair of jeans, or they're going to go back and buy a jacket next season, as long as the silhouette doesn't change too extreme from season to season. So I try to tell these young designers that we work with is that your formula has to be consistency and surprise. You have to have like a core business that guys can come back to, but you have to keep pushing the walls out a little bit and offering a lot of surprises. And that's pretty much what we do at the magazine and what Jim and I try to do every month.
Because one of the things I find happening now too is the magazine, you said global, and it's become a bit more inclusive now. We're starting to see, I mean, I've been wearing Visvim for years, but it's now appearing in the magazine. And that mm-hmm. idea of, you know, this again, these are narratives, and the Japanese are actually weirdly more American than the Americans are.
Yes.
With the stress jeans and the workwear. My favorite line for a number of years was number 9.
Right.
I mean, which basically you look like you stepped out of a Sergio Leone movie.
Yes.
You're wearing that kind
yes.
of stuff. And the magazine's really broadened its reach in a way that suggests that the world is now a place and not just Europe.
Yes. first of all, you're the coolest guy on the planet if you wore number 9 and you wear Visvim and you're wearing this incredible vintage plaid jacket and cool suede sneakers. It's fantastic. I feel like a schlump here in my dark suit. But I have to say that, yes, it is an exciting time. And you don't have to wear one hat. You don't have to, like, look like, you know, the boho, you know, surfer guy, or you don't have to look like the the Duke of Windsor. You don't have to, you know, you can mix all of these things up. It's like that's what's really fun about it.
See, I think that's a great thing of you hitting on something. I think what GQ has really done, especially in this last century, is given men permission. You know?
Yes.
And that you don't have to be the Duke of Windsor.
Yes.
On the other hand, you don't have to wear $9,000 worth of distressed Japanese wear so you look like a dock worker.
Exactly.
I mean, you can do something that intersects all these things.
Exactly.
Which is art, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, you're really like, you're your own canvas in a way. It's like you have to think about yourself before you walk out the door. And are, you know, if you want to jump on the ripped jeans trend, it doesn't mean that, you know, every ripped jean is right for you. You've got to treat your style life as a little bit of a laboratory. It's certainly the way we do it at the magazine. If we want to endorse, you know, our favorite 6 pairs of ripped jeans, let's say, we will try on 300 pairs of ripped jeans. And when you see it in the magazine, you can believe that the jeans that we show are the ones that we really endorse, are the ones that we think that you should wear. But we're also going to talk to the real guy. We do a continuing series called Project Upgrade, where we literally, you know, kamikaze guys off the street and bring them in. And, you know, they might have, you know, reasonably good style, but we know there's a diamond in the rough under there. So.
I'm just always amazed you can find so many guys wearing what I like to call non-ironic triple pleated pants.
There's still a lot of pleated pants out there and pirate shirts. And I think the transformation is incredible. Project Upgrade is probably, you know, near the very top of my list of one of my favorite things to do. And just to see their faces when they, you know, after they've been all tailored and put into a fitted shirt and seeing that they can wear some things that maybe they only thought they could see in the magazine.
But the funny thing is, in the magazine really captures this, the happiness of them. Oh, I can look like this.
Yeah. Oh, it's true. It's true. I don't know if you saw the Tom Ford upgrade. The purpose of that was not saying that, you know, if you wear all Tom Ford clothes, they're going to make everybody look great. That was not necessarily the point of the Tom Ford upgrade. The Tom Ford upgrade, we did that because we wanted Tom's voice in the magazine. We wanted his attitude and his opinion. So, yes, the guy is upgraded to Tom Ford, but the basic rules and the elements and the points that Tom is making can be achieved with other brands also. If he's saying, like, if you're tall and lanky, a double-breasted works on you, it's not necessarily that you have to buy a Tom Ford double-breasted suit. Great if you can afford it, but if you can't, there's a lot of other options out there. So, you know, the upgrades, especially the designer upgrades, we did one with Michael Kors, are really there to show that, you know, there are the designers out there also are great voices for our readers. And there's actually common sense, and there's rules, and there's passion for getting dressed every morning from the point of view of the designer. It's not always from the editors of the magazine.
Well, at a time, you have to come back.
Oh, my God. Anytime. I'm here.
My pleasure. My guest is Jim Moore.
Thank
you. He's celebrating 35 years at GQ. He's the creative director there. Our recording engineer here at NPR in New York is Neil Rausch. The show is mixed by Kat Yor. It's edited, it's cut, as we say, by Blake Veit, who's the associate producer. I'm not even the coolest guy in public radio. It's The Treatment. To catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.